Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Vayetze. This week, Rabbi Michael Hatton discusses Vayetze. Rabbi Michael Hatton is a member of the Pardes faculty. And now, Rabbi Michael Hatton.
Parshat Vayetze describes Yaakov's flight from his brother Esav. After having deftly secured the patriarchal blessings and granted the covenant of Avraham his forebear, Yaakov is sent by his father Yitzchak and his mother Rivka to the land of Aram Naharaim and to the city of Haran, there to find refuge from Esav's burning anger in the house of Lavan, Rivka's brother. Decades earlier, Avraham's loyal servant Eliezer had traveled the same path in search of Yitzchak's mate and had unexpectedly found himself at the house of Betuel, Avraham's own nephew and Lavan's father. There, he had secured the hand of Betuel's daughter Rivka to be Yitzchak's wife and had lavished her family and especially her brother Lavan with precious gifts. Now, Yaakov retraces Eliezer's steps. But in contrast to Eliezer's laden camels and extensive entourage, he arrives as a fugitive at Haran's outskirts, pausing at the well to catch his breath. Like Rivka before her, Rachel, Lavan's daughter, providentially appears on the scene, not in the guise of a water drawer, but as a shepherdess. Yaakov introduces himself as her long-lost kin, and the startled girl hurries home to inform her family of his unexpected appearance. Finally, Yaakov is escorted to Lavan's door, but unlike his grandfather's devoted retainer, he arrives bereft of material possessions and stricken with fear for his future. Graciously, Lavan extends an invitation to the hapless figure before him, and immediately Yaakov takes up the task of caring for Lavan's sheep. Yaakov, already smitten at the well with Rachel's kindness and beauty, now offers to serve Lavan for 7 years in order to have her hand in marriage. Lavan, ever presenting a calm, kind, and considerate mien to the outside observer, but constantly churning beneath with malicious schemes, immediately accepts, but without delay conspires to do otherwise. As the fateful marriage day fades into evening, and the shadows flee before night's gathering gloom, Lavan instead positions his older daughter Leah, concealed by an impenetrable veil, under the blissful canopy. Yaakov, blithely unaware of Lavan's subterfuge, pledges his vows to her instead. Discovering the cruel trick on the morrow, Yaakov is politely but firmly rebuffed by his new father-in-law. It is not the custom in our place to give the younger before the older. But, Lavan offers, I will also give you the other one, Rachel, for 7 more years of service. Yaakov agrees to the new terms, and in the process acquires for himself a second wife. Much of the remainder of the Parsha, direct outcome of Lavan's vicious ploy, is consumed by a description of the terrible hurt and great upheaval that is occasioned by Yaakov's marriage to the two sisters, Leah and Rachel. Theirs is a household torn by envy, racked by resentment, and filled with unfriendly rivalry for Yaakov's love. Many children are born to Yaakov between them and their maidservants, but the joy of childbearing brings in its wake no tranquility or fulfillment. Over the course of the 20 years that Yaakov spends in Lavan's service, his wives bear him 11 sons and 1 daughter. 6 of the children are the offspring of Leah. 2, of her maidservant Zilpah. Two are born by Rachel's maidservant Bilhah, and the last, beloved Yosef, by Rachel herself. The names of the children invariably address their respective mothers' feelings of rejection, anguish, and perpetual hope of securing Yaakov's exclusive love. On the one hand, the Torah's account presents a powerful argument against the practice of bigamy or polygamy, for it suggests that a household of two or more wives is fertile breeding grounds for more than just children. It is a recipe for strife, jealousy, and never-ending grief. The vast majority of polygamous relationships described in the Tanakh are full of distress and confrontation. Avraham and Sarah Hagar, Yaakov and Leah Rachel, Elkanah and Chana Penina, David and his wives, and of course the extreme case of King Solomon. The inherent menace of polygamy is spelled out in the Torah's directive, in Sefer Devarim chapter 21, to not overlook the firstborn son, though he may be the offspring of the hated wife. In short, it is not surprising that normative Judaism eventually outlawed the practice over 1,000 years ago, with the proclamation of the famous ban against bigamy by Rabbeinu Gershom Meor HaGola, the great 10th century German sage and acknowledged leader of Ashkenazic Jewry. Of course, the modern state of Israel also proscribes it, and Sephardim are duty-bound to abide by its laws. On the other hand, we are left to ponder the deeper significance of the Torah's account. How are we to understand the narratives of Leah and Rachel? Why does Providence conspire to create a household full of discord and dissension? Is there more to the account than simply an expression of the protagonist's personal trauma? We may begin our investigation by noting that the Parsha of Vayetze is a self-contained unit. In the Torah scroll, there are no breaks between the episodes of the Parsha because they represent a single continuum. Structurally, we may nevertheless note the following discrete elements. Number one, Yaakov flees from Canaan, is offered a special promise of divine protection and eventual return, and he utters a vow. Number two, he arrives in Haran at the well, meets with Rachel, and is welcomed into Lavan's home. Number three, Yaakov becomes Lavan's shepherd, hoping to marry Rachel, but in the end abruptly acquires her sister Leah as his wife as well. Number four, Leah has offspring, but her hopes of securing Yaakov's love go unanswered. Rachel is jealous of Leah's fecundity, and a competition ensues to produce more children. Number five, Yaakov states his desire to return home and requests his wages. But Lavan deceives him, forcing Yaakov to adopt a stratagem to secure what is rightfully his. Number six, Yaakov and his now substantial household flee Canaan bound from Lavan, as the latter is preoccupied with shearing his sheep. Number seven, Lavan pursues them. He overtakes them at Mount Gilad. But in a nighttime message, God warns him from harming Yaakov. Number eight, Yaakov and Lavan conclude a mutual non-aggression treaty. And Yaakov continues his journey westwards towards the land. It is readily apparent from the breakdown that the story's most prominent theme, the thread that draws together all of the separate episodes, is that of exile and redemption. As the Parsha begins, Yaakov is forced to leave Canaan, finds refuge as a foreigner in the house of Lavan. There he acquires wives and wealth, but no existential security, and in the end he is forced to flee back to his rightful home, the land of Israel. Lavan, the gracious host, soon stripped of his mask and self-transformed into the oppressive tyrant, attempts to foil the divine plan. But in the end, he cannot but acquiesce. God's watchful concern, ever present and supportive, but almost never obvious, ensures Yaakov's survival and sets into motion the mechanism of his return. In short, the Torah here spells out the kernel of the Jewish historical experience, to be repeated over and over again at charans almost too numerous to recount. The most striking parallel to our parsha, however, is the story of the descent to Egypt. The story of Egypt contains so many obvious thematic similarities that we may almost regard it as exactly the same tale. Thus, the descent to Egypt begins with the exile from Canaan of Yaakov's offspring. The initially kind reception of the Pharaoh soon becomes the brutal reaction of his namesake successor. The few Israelites nevertheless persevere to become many, in spite of Egypt's cruel measures. Israel eventually merits miraculous delivery from bondage and ventures forth accompanied by great wealth. Pharaoh's pursuit leads to a climactic confrontation in which Israel triumphs while the God-king's hordes are defeated. Again, the constant and palpable presence of God guides the chain of events to its preordained conclusion. To augment the almost complete thematic correspondence between the two accounts, we must take note of the following literary parallels as well. Yaakov works vayaavod for Lavan, and Israel labors for Pharaoh vayaavdu. God sees Yaakov's bondage, and he perceives Israel's subjugation. Ra'iti, ra'o ra'iti. Yaakov's family and wealth increase greatly, me'od me'od, and Israel multiplies abundantly, bim'od me'od. Yaakov flees vayivrach from Lavan's rage, and Israel escapes from Pharaoh, Barach. Yaakov is told that Lavan is told that Yaakov has fled, vayugad, and Pharaoh is informed that Israel has escaped, vayugad. Lavan gives chase, vayurdof, and Pharaoh pursues them, vayurdof. In fact, according to an ancient tradition, Pharaoh learns of Israel's failure to return on the third day of their exodus, and finally catches up with them at the Sea of Reeds on the seventh day. See Rashi's comments to Shmot 14, verse 5. This is exactly as is recorded concerning Lavan. Lavan was informed on the third day that Yaakov had fled. He pursued him a distance of 7 days. In short, the story of Yaakov and Lavan is the self-same story of Israel and Pharaoh, but with one critical and significant difference. Yaakov's enslavement and redemption is the account of an individual. Israel's bondage and exodus is the story of a people. The God of Israel, however, is interested and concerned with both dimensions of human existence, the personal and the particular, as well as the communal and the collective. If the Parsha of Vayetze is the story of Jewish exile and redemption, if Lavan is the archetypical host nation and Yaakov is his temporary and vulnerable guest, then Yaakov's wives and children must be the microcosm of the Jewish people. This is hardly surprising, considering the fact that the birth of these children constitutes more than the making of a family. The names of these children will be immortalized as the names of the 12 tribes, indicating that their births represent the nascence of the Jewish nation. Bearing in mind the Egyptian parallel, our structural model also indicates that the birth of the various children to Leah, Bilhah, Zilpah, and Rachel in turn is in fact a description of the dawn of the community of Israel. According to this reading, the personal story of Yaakov and his wives is also the tale of the entry of the people of Israel onto the stage of human history. With Yaakov's taking of wives and their birth of many children, the possibility arises for the first time of a larger family or group that will maintain its covenantal relationship with God, but at the same time slowly transform that relationship into a communal and eventually a national model. To quote Rashi, the matriarchs were prophetesses who were aware that 12 tribes would be born to Yaakov and that these 12 would descend from 4 wives. We may suggest that the matriarchs possessed a dim awareness, an intuitive subconscious realization that theirs was the task and privilege of driving the historical process forward to eventually culminate in the establishment of a nation. To put the matter differently, fully developed states are not generated out of thin air. They are the patient product of generations of cultivation and nurturing, and no small amount of struggle and pain. Great are the individuals who are perceptive enough to comprehend that their labors of child-rearing also constitute nation-building. All of this inevitably brings us back to Leah Rachel and the fractious family. Why does the Torah seem to set up a dynamic that is sure to produce friction? Why does the text devote so much attention to the convoluted relationship of these two? How do we explain the Torah's only recorded case of polygamy involving sisters? Although the local individual account strikes us as troubling, projecting the story to its national dimension makes it eminently intelligible. Just as surely as the essence of Parshat Vayetze is not simply to describe events in the lives of Yaakov and Lavan, but rather to trace the broad historical sweep of Jewish history, so too, the story of Leah and Rachel and their children is more than the account of their personal lives. It is a concise description of the awesome trials and challenges that their descendants will face in their valiant attempts to forge a nation and to maintain its unity and integrity. The children of Leah include a number of prominent players, but chief among them is Yehuda. In the course of the Joseph narratives, he will emerge as the most significant of the brothers. And as biblical history unfolds, the tribe of Yehuda will become its most potent element. The Davidic line will eventually descend from Yehuda. The capital of Jerusalem will be established on its borders. Rachel has only 2 children, Yosef and Binyamin. The remainder of Sefer Bereishit will revolve around the saga of Yosef. The tribes of Menashe and especially Ephraim that will descend from his sons will constitute the counterweight to Yehuda's influence in the national polity throughout the biblical period. These 2 poles, Yehuda and Yosef, Leah and Rachel respectively, represent 2 disparate elements that tend to be in a constant state of rivalry and conflict. The discord and hostility between Leah and Rachel, between the 2 sisters who cannot transcend their differences to unite in mind and purpose, foreshadows the future divisions that will hamper national unity and eventually drive the people of Israel apart to form 2 separate states. As the larger biblical story plays itself out over the course of 1,000 years, Yehuda and Yosef, or Yehuda and Ephraim Yisrael, in the typical prophetic formulation, gradually grow distant to become 2 disconnected monarchies in the aftermath of Solomon's ignominious end. The kingdom of Ephraim, with its eventual capital at Shomron, will be exiled by the king of Assyria in the 8th century BCE. The kingdom of Yehuda, with its capital in Jerusalem, enjoys another 150 years of partial independence until itself suffering exile at the hands of the Babylonians. Therefore, considering our parsha from this more cosmic perspective, it is clear that the animosity, enmity, and strife that color the relationship of the two sisters foreshadows the very difficult struggles that will unfold as the nation of Israel takes shape, and alludes to the conflicts that will continue to mold its development until the termination of its sovereignty and national independence, 2 millennia after Leah and Rachel have been laid to rest. The biblical people of Israel never succeed in overcoming sectarian and narrow interests to become a truly unified nation. The tribes often pull in different directions as a function of their local needs and concerns. Their leaders frequently find it difficult to see beyond the limitations of tribalism and factionalism to address the broadest possible concerns of all of the people. Even the destruction of the first temple did not bring an end to the divisiveness. The strife in Leah and Rachel is sadly still with us, awaiting its resolution. Fortunately, the prophets who lived through the destruction of the first Jewish state were granted a comforting vision of a messianic future, when Israel would be restored to its land and would finally succeed in transcending its internal divisions to become a single people. In the book of Yechezkel, the following vision is recorded. God said to me, "Mortal man, take a branch and inscribe upon it for Yehuda and the children of Yisrael, his compatriots. Take another branch and inscribe upon it for Yosef, the tree of Ephraim, and all of the house of Yisrael, his compatriots. Draw the branches together to become one in your hand. Behold, I will take the children of Israel from among the lands of their exile, and I will gather them from afar and bring them to their land. I will make them into a single nation in the land of the mountains of Israel. They will have but one king. They will no longer be two nations and will no longer divide into two kingdoms. My presence will be upon them and I will be their God and they will be my people." Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Hatton. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.